Okay, is everybody back?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, great. Okay, so we'll first start off with any announcements.
Well, this is Kristen Poppleton at Climate Generation and Wilsteger Legacy. There's still opportunity to register for our Summer Institute for Climate Change Education in 2 weeks, so if you're interested, visit climategen.org for more information. And then I also just, I know I had sent it around, but we are taking a delegation of teachers to COP21, and the information is also on climategen.org about that, but we are looking for classroom teachers. That's our top priority. And we'll be going the second week of COP, so December 6th to 11th. And feel free to email me or contact me if you have questions about that. But
Are these teachers anywhere around the country?
Anywhere around the country. And actually, as far as we can tell, we can take teachers outside the country. We've had some interest from a teacher in Canada as well. So as long as you have a current passport number, because we need... You need your number to submit names by June 22nd.
I see. Great. How many are you going to take?
We're looking around 10.
And are you going to get to go with them?
What's that?
Are you going to get to go with them?
I think I will be. We're still trying to figure that out. Yep.
Great.
Yeah.
Where do we apply for that?
That is, if you want to email me, Kristen, Kristen, at climategen.org, I could send you the link. But it's on our website,
thanks,
which is climategen.org.
Okay.
Yeah, you can find it that way, too.
What were you saying? I'm sorry, I got in 1 minute late.
Oh, I was just talking about the opportunity we're bringing. This is Kristen with Climate Generation. We're bringing a delegation of teachers to COP21 in Paris. And so I was saying if you want more information about that, you can email me or you can check out our website.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Are there other announcements? Well, one thing I did want to make people aware of, if you remember, we did a survey of the Clean Network in the spring of 2013, and the membership has grown from about 380 then to about 515 now, and things have changed a bit. So we are planning to do another survey, and we've kind of decided, given the timing, we don't want to do it over the summer. We'll probably implement it in the fall. And I just wanted everybody to know that was going to happen. So I don't want to have a huge number of people involved in creating the questions, but if there's issues that you think that we would be worthwhile getting information from the Clean Network about in terms of climate literacy efforts, you should certainly email me and we'll get you into the loop in terms of putting together that survey. Are there any other announcements?
So this is Martha. I'm moving to La Jolla. And I've been making proposals for Del Mar on sea level rise. So I'm starting to take on, as a coastal geologist, sea level rise jobs with cities in Southern California.
All right, great. What prompted the move to La Jolla?
I was asked by Scripps Oceanographic to come back and work on some projects, and I decided to put my daughter in high school at La Jolla High because it was ranked number 50 in the country for public schools, which is good.
I see. Good. Okay, are there other announcements? Okay, well, then if not, we will get on to our presentation for today. As I mentioned at the beginning of this, the slides were posted a little bit later than usual, but they are available online now. And so we are going to have Rachel Schwarm is going to talk to us today. Rachel is a sociologist and has been involved in and interested in how different groups of people in society make sense of and respond to energy and climate change problems. She is at Rutgers University, and she is going to talk to us today about enhancing climate literacy through social sciences. So with that, Rachel, I'll turn it over to you. It's helpful to refer to the slide numbers as you go along, because as we record it, or people come in late, they'll be able to find where you are.
Okay. So I'll start with slide number 2. And so the talk today, I'll just give you an introduction to myself, and then talk about the broader project that this effort is a part of, on where we're trying to integrate learning across natural social sciences and our approach to that. And then talk about the argument for social sciences as part of climate literacy and what social sciences could say. I understand there's kind of an interest. Also, people have an interest in kind of how do we use what we know from the social sciences about how people understand climate to inform how we teach about climate change. And I'm happy to kind of talk about that at the end too, but this really is focused on what kind of social science could we teach as part of teaching climate change that could help enhance climate literacy. And so, just as kind of background of where I'm coming from, I was an undergraduate. I studied a lot of kind of biogeochemical cycles and a second major in English, but was interested, you know, in things like carbon sinks and the missing carbon sink at that time. By the time I had finished my undergraduate work, I thought, oh, there's enough. We know enough about climate change to be acting, so why aren't we acting? And I thought, oh, it must be because scientists aren't communicating it well enough and getting their point across to Congress. And so I did my master's work focusing on that. And and by the end of that, you know, I was convinced it wasn't really strictly a problem of communication, but it was really more a political problem. And I went and worked in energy efficiency for 4 years at a group called the Consortium for Energy Efficiency that worked with utilities on demand-side management programs and trying to help. I worked on both the residential and commercial side, helping, you know, households and businesses to save energy under kind of what utilities could do to help reduce their loads. And then I returned and got my PhD in sociology at Michigan State University, a great program. Or at least I think so, in environmental science and policy that was interdisciplinary but still had a disciplinary PhD in sociology. Since then, my research interests have been on public opinion on climate change and also looking at how interorganizational networks, the politics of some energy efficiency stuff and how policy change happens, since that's very necessary towards climate change, addressing climate change, and then some work on kind of growing really out of public opinion on climate change, but really, you know, not just what do people think about climate change, but then what do they do about it, or how do our lifestyles adjust to address these kinds of things. And so now I have... I've been thinking about climate social science literacy. This is slide 4. I got this grant, Rebecca Jordan, who's a researcher and she just got promoted, so she's a professor now at Rutgers here with me, who does more science education and science learning. Had come to me and said, how about we do something here about learning to integrate natural and social sciences around your interests of climate change. And so we put in a proposal to develop a social and ecological framework for understanding climate change mitigation and adaptation, which I'll go into in a minute what that means. But we've put together a team of both natural scientists and social scientists, and then some more science ed folks. And the goal of this project really was to develop tools that will help undergraduate instructors develop integrated social and natural science classes in relation to the human climate system. And so part of this grows out of the fact that I teach an undergraduate course right now given to freshmen, and mostly freshmen, that is focused on climate change and energy, and has a team of a chemist, a physicist, a climatologist, an economist, and myself teaching the class. So this project partly came out of my interest in improving the integration of that class and that teaching. And so you'll have to forgive me. I know many of you focus on kind of the K-12 level, but the origins of this project kind of are in the undergraduate level. And so we're realizing we need to translate what this means kind of further out and to the K-12. So I kind of need your help with that. I might not be right on target for some of your interest at this point. But the next slide is 6. This project builds on ideas really that model-based reasoning is an important skill to teach undergraduates on how to move from abstract to specifics and theory to empirical. It builds on the idea that we can teach human climate dynamics, so it kind of really builds on kind of coupled human natural system dynamics thinking, but more specifically towards the human climate system. This is a really good opportunity to link social and natural science ways of knowing and practices. And then third, we chose this approach because we thought that, teaching human climate dynamics really provides an opportunity to get students to grapple with issues of data variability, uncertainty, probability, all these things, these science learning issues that students have a lot of challenges with. So slide 7. So the objectives of this project were kind of three steps. The first is to build a human climate dynamics model that identified the main components of this system and think about examples of data that could be used in class to explain pieces of the system and students could work with. To identify what habits of mind were necessary or student practices were necessary for understanding the relationships that we're identifying in this model and kind of identifying where there were similarities and differences in various disciplines. So grappling with the idea of how different social and natural sciences are or how much overlap there is. And I think Rebecca and I and our team come down in the space or the area that there's a lot of overlap in the practices or habits of mind between the social and natural sciences about how we generate data and evaluate data and how we really know what we know in those fields. But there certainly are differences, and particularly kind of at the outer edges of things. Our final project goal was to develop and refine a rubric that could be used for, professors that could help them assess students' habits of mind and, so that we could know how students were doing. And right now we're kind of to that part. That's kind of what will happen in our next meeting. And so next slide, 8, is where we developed the model of human climate dynamics. And these boxes have a lot kind of underlying them, but we basically really made our team, who came up with 1,000 boxes and, you know, condense things down and think about the relationships between things. And then we made them come up with kind of 5 statements, you know, that they thought students should know kind of content-wise under each of those boxes and relationships. And as you can see in red, the mitigation, geoengineering, adaptation are kind of the range of responses we've identified. And then that box down in the corner that's called capacity constraints, decision-making, is really where a lot of the social science happens, that talks about how societies are going to respond to impacts and which way they're going to go and how that influences human activities and further increases or decreases climate change. And so what we really...
Is it all right to ask a question, or do you want to wait hold on until the end?
I'm fine with asking as we go along.
Yeah, so this is Frank Niepold over at NOAA. I'm very intrigued by your work. And specifically, one of the issues we're struggling with is the connection of decision-making and education, and more specifically about citizenry in the public participation and the decision-making process. Is any of that showing up in that box that you just described?
Yeah, it definitely is. And I'm going to unpack that box a little bit more, and I'm not sure if we're there yet, Frank, but we're definitely interested in kind of what citizens need to know to kind of actively respond to climate change and engage and respond in climate change. And that part of that includes kind of being able to engage in politics or governance or, you know, kind of what they might need to know.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And so as we were looking through that, slide 9 just says what we're kind of working on right now. And the work I'm going to talk to you really comes out of that second bullet of where we were identifying it grows out of the first one, too, of where we were looking at this model. So when we were looking at this model on slide 8, what we realized is, wow, when we started making our claims and thinking about the resources that were around, what we saw was that on any of those boxes that are kind of connected kind of up on the top had a fair number of resources and were, you know, really, there was a lot out there to help us identify resources to teach around or what we would want, you know, what student practices would be, what kinds of exercises they could do, what kind of claims there are, and certainly the principles of climate literacy, you know, kind of had that covered. And so what we found was that bottom right-hand corner and then these kind of red arrows and these responses is what many of us on the team know about as far as social scientists, but, you know, it hasn't been addressed as much in the science ed literature as far as kind of teaching about this stuff. And so we got down, looked to the principles of climate literacy, and obviously many of you were involved in. And it said a climate literate person can understand, I'm on slide 11 now, the essential principles of Earth's climate system, assess scientifically credible information about climate change, communicate about climate and climate change in a meaningful way, and make informed and responsible decisions regard to actions that may affect climate. And we thought some social science knowledge or knowledge of the system and the human dimensions of it could really help people potentially go along. And I think as social scientists, we don't particularly have as I'm sure as educators, many of you don't either have an information deficit model of kind of giving people information and this is going to help them. But as a kind of necessary one piece of getting people to where they need to be able to respond, we thought there might be some social science that could help out with that. So we, you know, in the climate literacy principles, slide 12, it talks about the fact that, you know, the literacy principles focus on physical and biological sciences, but that, you know, they understand that an interdisciplinary approach would be useful in climate literacy, and it kind of talks about an effort being in development, which maybe some of you know what happened to that effort or where it's at, but we haven't found it, we saw that and thought, oh, this is good because we feel like we can do some of this, but it, I don't know if there's an existing institutional thing I'm not aware of.
I can answer that question. It's very simple. That initiative never happened.
Okay. I wasn't sure if it happened
something.
And died out or became something else. Or
well, what happened was is that we knew that the social science community needed to be involved in this space, that the climate literacy, and actually the real title of the guide is not actually just climate literacy, it's the climate science literacy. And
right.
We knew that that would not be sufficient to meet climate literacy, but the social science community never rallied the way the physical and natural science community did for our part, and we still are suffering from the lack of having a framework like the one you're describing. So it's very timely, and well, it was timely in 2009, but it's still very useful to consider how it would be going forward.
Yeah, and I think it's partly now that the social scientists have been getting their act together, really. So I think in 2009, the American Psychological Association came out with their report on kind of what psychology can say about climate science. And then following up really this year, the American Association of Geographers came out with their report, kind of like of what they can say. And then I'm on the task force for sociology, and we're coming out. There's a book coming out in August that's really the culmination of trying to say this is what sociology can say about this. So I think, like, there's starting to be a feeling that, like, okay, now we're ready. We've kind of got our own camps organized a little bit more and know what's robust. And so I'll talk a little bit about what that is. So slide 13, so I think the timing, there was definitely a lag on the
Can I just make a
community.
Request? Can I just make a request to some other participants? There's all kinds of noises. It sounded like somebody was in the kitchen and other people are playing with their microphones. If everybody who's not actually actively asking a question could put their phones on mute, that would improve the experience for the rest of us. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I won't put mine on mute. But so slide 13. You know, we asked, can a stronger understanding of the human dimensions of climate change advance climate literacy goals? There's some indications that these things are important for people taking climate change action. So a study coming out of the Lazarowitz, Rosa Renouf, kind of up at Yale group, had found that people's belief in human causation, risk perception, and certainty in global warming, which are kind of things you folks are dealing with, but getting them information about the science and the impacts are important. But then there's this kind of starred slide I have that talks about collective response efficacy, and that's really the belief that that people have that actions to reduce a risk will be effective and that your group is able to work together to achieve a goal. So there, the ideas about their social world are coming into play and influencing whether people undertake, they defined climate change activism here as kind of volunteering with an organization to reduce global warming or writing a letter to your you know, local elected official or something like that. And so it's not even an extreme, like they're out in the street marching or anything. And so similarly, on a qualitative study, people found that people do, they kind of are grappling with this idea that it's a collective problem that, you know, as a single person, you, you know, it's hard to make an impact that's going to change the tide. But at the same time, people are hesitant to spend a lot of time politically organizing because they believe the government is unwilling to act or won't act, you know, in response to groups demanding it. And so people's ideas, anyway, about the social and political and economic conditions seem to be influencing, you know, willingness to act and engage. And those are just, I mean, I think there's a lot more research to be done there about what do people think about the politics, like what are people's perceptions of what's going on here socially and politically and economically around climate change. And so we have kind of two rationales for why social science and climate literacy, you know, might be important. One is that kind of these some naive models of politics or economics and human behavior, just as we've talked about kind of naive models or misconceptions in people's mental models of the science of climate change, may be responsible for, you know, maybe blocking some of people's actions or decreasing the public's ability to communicate and act responsibly and effectively. And then the second rationale we have for integrating social science into climate literacy is that we really, I'm on slide 17 now, really believe that many of the ability to understand the social science behind climate change and the human dimensions of climate change can reinforce overall scientific literacy. And for those who might not gravitate towards the natural sciences, it gives them an opportunity to learn those same habits of mind and understanding in a different context, right? And so model-based reasoning, variation and uncertainty, integration across scales and systems, you know, are all you know, habits of mind that are important for both understanding the social sciences and the natural sciences. Slide 18 kind of is some of the work we've been doing around this. We've been making claims, evidence, and practices models for the kind of whole model I put up there. And so we have some claims about human drivers that I'll talk a little bit more about. But then looking at kind of some exemplar evidence or studies that have been done, the kind of data they use, how scientists know this or what kind of analysis they use, and then what kind of student practices are associated with understanding these this knowledge and how we know what we know. And these student practices really come off of the next generation in science learning, the standards. And because we have some natural science blocks that we're doing claims, evidence, and practices for, in addition to some of the social science claims, we're being able to see where these student practices can overlap. So when we were looking for the social science, we were looking at these fields now that many of them have studies out, and we were kind of using two criteria, I guess, for guiding. Everybody kind of feels like there's a ton to say, and, you know, social scientists, whatever you study, you feel like really that's the most important thing for people to understand, or, you know, so you kind of had to come up with that criteria. So we, you know, tried to focus on what was most useful to advancing climate literacy goals, which I think still is questionable, or there could be a lot of literature, a lot of research, I feel like, done on helping us to know what kind of understanding about the social world would advance climate literacy goals, but then also focusing on what really the most robust findings are and kind of the things that social science kind of knows what it, you know, there's accumulated studies. And That is one thing with social science that's often a challenge, is to get that kind of accumulation of knowledge, because studies might be smaller or very context dependent, and so being able to aggregate those is something that social scientists do, but that you need a number of studies to kind of get there. So we first looked at climate literacy principles and what we could contribute on that end. I'm on slide 20. And we identified kind of the last four that are in red there as things we thought that the social sciences had something to say about. And then we identified some additional things that we thought don't fall under the existing climate science literacy principles. And so, for example, life on Earth depends on, is shaped by, and affects climate. We have an anthropologist on our team, and she, you know, was talking about, is able to kind of, you know, delve into the literature on long-term droughts and societal development or demise. And so she started, you know, she said the literature from there is really talking about that, you know, the factors that we know influence how climate impacts society and how society reacts are influenced by things like population densities, urbanization, the inability of geopolitical borders to change or move, that, you know, reduces the ability to migrate, and the inability of systems of governance to adapt or be flexible, right? And so he kind of brought that literature to bear on these things. And so a lot of what social sciences bring is, you know, when you're kind of talking about the scientific side of it, it's kind of very broad in the sense of, like, it will have these impacts. And social scientists are very interested in on the word I want to use, inequality or variation in impacts, right, and how it impacts different people in different places across time and space. So, for example, the next slide is, or next climate literacy principle we addressed was, our understanding of climate is improved through observations, theoretical studies, and modeling. There's some very good studies now of, there are social scientists that are studying scientific processes. This goes back to, they used to really study a lot of bench scientists and how chemists do their work and how those social processes and professional practices are, you know, shaped. But, for example, now we know from these studies that climate science assessments such as the IPCC tend to be inherently conservative. We know that there's been a lot of research kind of looking at scientific consensus. Many of you are familiar with things like Naomi Oreskes' work, and that her work, but that hers and others' work, you know, for example, people will say, oh, there was scientific consensus that, you know, in the 1970s that there was going to be global cooling. Well, no, there wasn't science. That wasn't scientific consensus, right? But then they also have looked at, you know, that there are high percentages of peer-reviewed scientific studies or surveys of scientists that affirm that there is consensus that anthropogenic climate change is occurring, right? So looking at what is the nature of consensus, and this has been found actually to be, at least people's beliefs in consensus has been found to be kind of an influencing factor in their ultimate belief in climate change or, you know, willingness to act on it in surveys. The third principle was that human activities are impacting the climate, and so we have a lot of great cross-national analysis of kind of human drivers of greenhouse gas emissions that, you know, consistently find that population size and gross domestic product per capita, which is, you know, just the size of the economy or consumption, are the principal direct driving forces of greenhouse gas emissions. There's been a lot of research kind of trying to figure out what else is around there, but it turns out, you know, it's kind of as far as what else influences greenhouse gas emissions for countries, and there's not a ton that works as significantly as those two things. We also know about a lot about household energy consumption that's been studied for decades, and you know how households use energy that's greenhouse gas intensive, what influences those things, and not just kind of the structure of the household, but institutions, values, beliefs, norms, the culture that's around it, and so things like, for example, California, because of certain policies that have been in place, but and then a culture that's really developed around it, you know, uses 42% less electricity per household than the rest of the U.S., right? So significant difference even within country. Then adding to climate change will have consequences for the Earth system and life, slide 24. Like I said, as social scientists, they tend to focus a lot on variations across societies. And so, you know, adding to the idea that it will have more consequences for some than for others, right? And ideas around climate risk, and knowing that that's a factor of both the physical hazards that you can know something about from the natural science, but then also the social vulnerabilities, which we know are things like levels of poverty, political power, social capital, access to resources. And so an example of that, for example, is migration, where, you know, people can move away from climate, you know, if some place becomes an unhealthy climate, unsupportive climate, but that you need adequate economic resources to do that. In low-income migrants often end up on low-cost lands that are already prone to these risks, right? Topics that we identified that don't fit under, that we felt like there were robust findings that don't fit under current climate literacy that might be effective in advancing literacy goals are getting people to understand that public opinion on climate change is a social and psychological phenomenon, understanding the governance and political systems and how they interact with climate change, and also thinking about the role for humanities. And so, for example, you kind of get a lot on public opinion since you have both myself and Aaron McWright as kind of working on this project. But, for example, you know, understanding skepticism, there's kind of modest percentages. I don't know, we put it at usually between 7 to 10% of U.S. citizens who are skeptical of climate science and who deny the reality and seriousness of climate science. But these are different than, and also there's kind of a larger percent that goes up to like 30% that has some doubt or some uncertainty about some aspect of climate change. But these are higher. This is anomalous than, you know, to the rest of the world. So you're, as educators, you're dealing with a special population. And in general, publics around the world perceive, that's supposed to read, that the U.S. we tend to perceive impacts as less severe and more distant than other problems, or that's actually consistent generally. Also, individual predictors are, you know, of how people perceive climate change. We know that values or identity, political orientation, obviously, are the most consistent factors of people's opinion on climate change. Gender, with females being kind of more concerned or believing more about climate change, tends to be a consistent finding. I'm on slide 28 now. I want to leave room for questions, so I'm trying to move along. And also, there's increasing findings now. There's been maybe 20 studies about how the weather impacts our belief about climate change on any given day. And so this seems to be something that it's not more broad climatic conditions, but kind of current weather conditions seems to impact those, at least in a not overly strong, but one factor that's been investigated anyway. So this is something, Frank, you mentioned about kind of, you know, people's, what they need to know to kind of engage, I think, in climate change action. And, for example, it's important, I think, to know in the U.S. that much of what's being done about climate change isn't happening at the federal level, although now under the Clean Air Act it is, but that, you know, action has been taken at the state and local level, and that, you know, for as citizens who want to engage, they need to look and go there. And Aaron and I right now are fighting about what else needs to go in this chapter, so if you, or this kind of section, he said, oh, I don't know, there's too much to say and we can't identify specifics, so maybe it's something we don't address here, but I feel pretty strongly about addressing it. So if you have, anybody has ideas about what else we need to say or what other kind of areas, I'd be interested in hearing it. As far as how do we advance this climate social science literacy, that's another thing we're kind of thinking about right now is, first thing, obviously, strengthening the social science and the knowledge where it's needed, building an approach that advances an understanding of how the natural and social sciences produce knowledge. And so that kind of has, I think, emphasizes common mechanisms of knowledge production and the students can understand how they know what they know. And certainly moving towards interdisciplinary classes, which is something our products hope to be able to do. But I'm interested to learn more about how that's happening at the K-12 level, I guess, since I'm not sure.
This is Tamara. I'm just going to make a comment on that. Well, I don't think there's been explicit efforts to think about integrating them. A lot of what many of us are thinking about in terms of developing curriculum is making things relevant or place-based, which then makes it interesting and useful for the students and relevant to the students, so that brings in the social science aspects of it. So I don't think it's quite explicit as you've been describing, but mm-hmm. I think it's beginning to happen.
Okay.
This is Joe Levine. I have a couple comments here. I think that... Okay. Only one place during your presentation did you use the word belief, but people very often say things like, what percentage of the public believes in climate change? And as a long-term survivor of the struggle over evolution education, I'm a strong advocate that those of us in all the sciences, including social sciences, should be very careful about how we use the word belief as opposed to the word understand and either accept or reject, because it's very easy to say, I don't believe in this. If you force somebody to say, well, actually, I don't understand it, and my knee-jerk belief is not to accept it, you know, I think that that's an interesting sort of psychological aspect to this that's mm-hmm. worthwhile. The other thing is to reinforce what you just said about referencing local events. It just so happens that last night, John Holdren was on a NOAA webinar. And what's intriguing to me is that very high-level scientists and communicators and policymakers like Holdren are getting more definitive about saying, yes, it's okay to talk about hurricane Superstorm Sandy or the blizzards in the Northeast and stuff like that as being associated with climate change. Obviously, you can't say that climate change caused any particular event, just like you can't say a ball player, like the steroids that a ball player might be taking enabled him to get a particular home run. But people are getting much more firm about overcoming scientists' reluctance to make those kinds of local associations.
Right.
And Frank, if you're still on, you might want to comment on that.
No, I'm definitely online. It's a little noisy where I am, but there's so much that I want to say. I'm having a hard time figuring out which part of it I want to talk about. I'm incredibly valuing the work that your team has done, and want to explore how to take this further. But I think that we're in a different place than we were in 2008, 2009, as a community, as a field, and as a growing field or a field of fields. But how the education interface with learning about these issues translates to citizens or future workforce is a critical piece of our work that's going to shape what we do for decades. And I think that whatever I say at this point in time is only going to be just one piece of it. What I'm really interested in is where do we take this beyond the call today, and how do we deepen this? And if we have to open up, revise the climate literacy guide or create a companion, I'm open.
Don,
just one last point. I'm the federal lead for the climate literacy guide. So basically the rule we have was if it was time to do another one or to revise it. That's my process to own, and you guys tell me, is it time, and we'll do it, or if it's time to build a companion, which we always talk about, but we never had the right body of work, and it sounds like we do.
Great. If I can respond to that for a minute. I do think, Frank, that I don't know how it could impact your process or whether to be a guide or integrated or I think it needs to certainly at this point, like I said, I feel like the social sciences are getting ready. They're getting organized on several fronts as far as how do we integrate more into, global research, climate, and that research, and how do we integrate more into the IPCC, and right, people are kind of getting their act together, and so I think this is one more front where people are kind of ready to go. It certainly needs to involve, at this point, it's kind of five of us, social scientists, and so there's a much broader group that can be engaged that will have different things to say, But I think those reports that each discipline has been putting out are going to really provide a really good basis for doing that, because now we know kind of where the consensus points are, at least within fields. So, getting those teams to now engage across the social sciences and then with the natural sciences.
Right.
Probably good.
Rachel, this is Jane Heinz-Fry. And right now I'm looking at a Venn diagram that integrates math, science, and ELA practices. It's produced by NGSS at NSPA. And boy, would I love to see the social sciences integrated with this, because there's an incredible amount of overlap in the practices. And
right.
The time is right for this. And Frank, maybe this plays into the kind of revisions that could happen in the climate literacy piece. Just pull in those social sciences strongly. I was very interested in hearing what you had to say about the additional pieces, what you could address with the climate literacy principles, and things that you could address that went beyond where they currently are. So this is very thought-provoking. This is very powerful. And thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you. I wish my co-authors were on the call.
Well, please pass on our... one quick thing, and then Don, I'll let you go, and I'll hush. Is one of the events we recently had at the White House on climate education You know, the educators came together with a lot of different people, and basically, bottom line, Tamara, you were in the room.
Yes, I was.
There may be other on the call who were there as well, but we really called for all educators to be involved in this issue, not just the science or even the earth science classroom or the environmental science. It's really all education. And I think, you know, like the Venn diagram of only three circles, it's actually more circles than three that, Jane, you were bringing forward. So I think, you know, a richer articulation of how the learning happens across the domains and intersecting with the domains is really apt for focus in the near term. I completely feel that we're there on many fronts.
This is Karen Holweg. I have a quick question, and thank you for your presentation. I'm wondering whether you've looked at all at the environmental literacy models as to provide some assistance in integrating the social sciences and natural sciences and knowledge dispositions, competencies, and behaviors kinds of things as one possible insight into how that integration might occur. And also I'm wondering whether you've involved your students in looking at this at all, or whether this is strictly at this point a exercise among the scientists of various disciplines that you've brought together.
So to the environmental literacy extent, we have a Jennifer Meta Robinson, who actually is a humanities person who worked on Indiana University's environmental literacy and kind of sustainability literacy. They kind of did something across the university saying, like, you know, how are we going to do this and what does this mean? And so she's kind of steeped in that. But I don't think we've integrated to the extent you're talking about, you know, looking at knowledge dispositions or thinking about how that relates. So that's certainly something we can think about and think about the implications for this. And then right now, this has been just this team, our team of researchers. Although we are getting ready just here at Rutgers to do a survey of our students about kind of climate knowledge. And we have some climate mental models from kind of the classic surveys that have been done about people's mental models on climate change. But I've snuck in a couple of questions about social, what their mental models of the social science, you know, or the social, not social science, but of the social world or the economic, you know, system or things like that might be like, to kind of start thinking about that. But we haven't engaged students at this point. What would you think as far as...
So you have not. So you've not integrated some of these models into the classes you've been teaching yet?
I personally have been integrating them into my classes as we've gone along, but no, we're kind of still, since we're in the mid-development of this, this project wraps up in August, and then we're, so for example, I teach this interdisciplinary class this fall, and I'm working on getting these things, I'm trying to pitch them to my fellow teachers right now, you know, which all of you know, right, there's kind of a... the class is already set up and has been running for 4 or 5 years, so they say, hey, I've got a better idea. I've got a way,
so
I want to try
it
this new way.
Most of your work right now has been with your diverse team to develop this model that then you could, that educators could then use to integrate these concepts into their classes. Is that
Our work to date is really, just focusing kind of on getting our own act together, I guess, and how we think about it, but not haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the goal is, so for example, we'll be at the Ecological Society of America in Baltimore this August, and, you know, the goal is to start getting folks to hopefully pick up, and we will have kind of finished products then to pick up some of the ideas. But it's also, it doesn't create a complete course. It's much more meant to give, at this point, undergraduate educators some kind of tools and information to make it easier to either integrate into a current course or to create their own kind of human climate course, but for their own, you know, preferences, I guess. So it provides kind of some tools to do that, but doesn't just create a course.
Are there any other questions?
This is Ben. Well, I'll just make a comment. This is Don Duganhass, and the idea about interdisciplinarity at K-12, I think, is incredibly important, and some other folks have already chimed in on what I was going to say, but I can't not say anything. So I think the NGSS with the connections boxes in the performance expectations is providing an opportunity that we've not seen, at least in a long, long time, on how to start thinking about those interdisciplinary courses. And honestly, I think that if we don't do that, the NGSS won't make much of a difference in what happens in schools. So I oscillate on being pessimistic and optimistic that maybe opens the door towards those interdisciplinary approaches in K-12.
I think interdisciplinary approaches in K-12 are on the cusp of either happening or not, and whether they will or not will depend on a combination of how individual states decide to implement either NGSS or their six words different from NGSS, so it's not branded as Fed involvement in state affairs, in terms of curricula and directives to teachers. And I would like to say to anybody who's online here, including, of course, you, Rachel, that as one of the authors of the most widely utilized, I'm very interested in trying to get some of this interdisciplinary stuff in there. And I think that some of the discussions we've had both in-house among authors about NGSS and misinterpretations of that people are already making of it could be very useful for you in that regard.
Are there any other questions or comments?
Yeah, this is Dave Finnegan, and I do a program in schools called Climate Changes Elementary. We go to K-6 and K-8 schools, and we've always seen it as an interdisciplinary program. In fact, when we have our teachers' meeting in the onset of the program, I always tell the teachers that we do not STEM, but STREAM FGH. And STREAM is science, technology, R for reading and writing, E for environment, energy, and engineering, A for art, M for music, M for math. And we do foreign language, geography, and history, because that's what they do. They don't parse things into the discrete elements as we do at the university level. They have to teach the whole child. So our program is perforce a interdisciplinary program, and we see the children as kinesthetic, spatial, interpersonal, musical, environmental, verbal, mathematical learners, and we try to hit all of those learning styles in our program. Otherwise, we're leaving kids behind, and we're leaving entire areas of this subject out. And so very important to us at the place where the rubber meets the road, which is school by school, to look at an integrated, interdisciplinary approach rather than looking at it from a single discipline.
Okay.
Are there any other comments or questions? Okay, well, Rachel, this was very, very informative. I know all of us on the CLEAN Network have thought that the social sciences were an essential aspect of this from the beginning, and we're really glad that you're working on developing these kinds of tools to help everybody really integrate it into their teaching better. Your slides have a lot of food for thought, and as the references that you gave with your abstracts, so I'll be looking at those also. So thank you very much for your presentation.
Great.
Well,
can
thank
we get
you
Rachel's
so much
email?
For... What?
Can we get Rachel's email? Is it shwomrac at rci.rutgers.edu? Is that?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yeah, and that's fine. Okay. I should have put in it. I should have put it in the presentation, but I guess I didn't. But that is it.
Could you repeat that again, please?
Rachel did that.
What was that?
Repeat your email address again, Rachel.
Oh, my email is shwomrac at rci.rutgers.edu. And, and I just want to thank you all so much for listening and your important feedback, because it's great to have an audience. So we'll be working on this, and then definitely trying to follow up. And my co-author, or also on Rebecca Jordan, who really is more the science ed side of things. I'm definitely going to kind of push back some of your comments to her, particularly around, thinking about the social sciences and the NGSS, because I feel like she has more competency in that area, and has been looking thinking more about how you teach social sciences, and she has more experience with K through 12 as well. So,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, there's a lot for us to follow up on. Thank you.
Yes. So, and just so that you know, not everybody spoke, but we had 18 people on the teleconference this afternoon, so that was very good.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all for your time.
All right.
Thanks all.
Bye.
Thank you.